Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Once again, the white supremacist movement is in the news.
The Southern Poverty Law Center said that he had been part of the white power music scene since 2000. He'd started a band called End Apathy in 2005, which had some provocative lyrics and racist album covers. And there have been some pictures that have surfaced of Page standing in front of a flag with a swastika.
That was NPR's Dina Temple-Raston talking about Wade Page, who on Sunday walked into a Sikh temple outside of Milwaukee and shot 9 people, killing 6 of them before killing himself. Wade Page was an Army veteran and a white supremacist, playing in so-called hate core rock bands, bands that play heavy metal rock music with racist and hateful lyrics. It's safe to say most of us did not even know such a music genre existed before Sunday. So this hour we'll look at the state of the hate movement in the United States. Ryan Lenz is a senior writer at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Ryan Lenz, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
What is the state of the white supremacist movement, the state of the groups in this country right now?
Well, we here at the Southern Poverty Law Center have watched these, watched hate groups for a number of years, and in the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen a dramatic growth. Since 2000, when we counted 602 hate groups, that number has since risen to 1,018 last year. These are groups that have grown, that have seen their memberships grow, largely for a number of reasons, we think. One, we've seen the election of the nation's first black president. 2, there's been widespread economic dislocation, which tends to lead to despondency, which ultimately leads people to search out these groups. And I think most notably is the fact that many see that there's a changing racial makeup in this country, which many whites possibly see as a threat. And so they've searched out these groups.
We're talking with Ryan Lenz, senior writer at the Southern Poverty Law Center, about the state of the white supremacist movement here in the United States in the wake of the shootings outside of Wisconsin. Let's bring another voice into the conversation, Kathleen Blee. She teaches at the University of Pittsburgh and has studied white supremacist groups. Kathleen, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
We know these groups are out there. We see they are expanding, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. How common is violence among these groups?
Violence is actually perhaps increasingly common, and in part it has to do with the change of structure in white supremacism in the last couple decades. So instead of, as in the past you had a series of groups and organizations that were linked together and coordinated, now you have, as Ryan was talking about, many more groups, some of them quite small, some of them bigger, that exist in a network that are only very loosely connected. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways they're connected is through white power music. Mm-hmm. And one of the aspects of having this small, uncoordinated network is that you have a lot more people, perhaps, that are able to and interested in acting violently, often even on their own.
Our phone number is 292-8513, and our email is allsides@wosu.org. We are talking about the state of the white supremacist movement in the United States, trying to get a better idea of how large it is, what their activities are, what their motivations are, and what's behind the movement. Our question for you is, what's the balance between free speech and preventing violence? How can we should we control white supremacist organizations? 292-8513. Our email is allsides@wosu.org. This hate core rock music, frankly, I mean, I'm not surprised it existed. I just didn't know anything about it. Ryan Lenz, how new is this music genre?
Oh, this music has pretty much existed since the 80s, when the first real racist skinhead groups started to emerge. You saw those groups on all sorts of television shows, I think most famously on Geraldo Rivera.
Uh-huh.
And so this music has proliferated. It has grown. A number of years ago, we here at the SPLC counted the number of groups that we could find, and we came up with about a little over 100 of them. These are groups that have that have a large presence online. They're advertised through word of mouth. They exist at all sorts of racist festivals where they have music festivals. In fact, Wade Michael Page, who was a founding member of that band End Apathy, he regularly toured those festivals. One of the big festivals was called Hammerfest, which was a festival that draws anywhere from 50 to 150 people. It changes locations every year. It's put on by the Hammerskins, which was the group that that Page became a member of last year.
Kathleen Blee from the University of Pittsburgh, has the internet and technology and MP3s, and it's much easier to get access to this music now.
And absolutely, the music is very important. And in my interviews with women and men who have been pulled into white supremacist groups and into the movement, I found that white power music is a very powerful recruitment tool. So people will go to festivals, concerts, listen to white power music, have it exchanged on the internet. Often they don't start out as haters. They may not even be that interested in issues of race. And that music is a powerful way that people learn to hate and learn to be connected to a network of other racial haters.
We're speaking about the state of the white supremacist movement, what's behind it, what's fueling it, is it growing, with two experts in the field, Ryan Lenz from the Southern Poverty Law Center and Kathleen Blee from the University of Pittsburgh. Does the music, Ryan, does it fuel violence? Does the music itself, it's a recruiting tool, it's a bonding tool for these groups, does it fuel the violence? Do the lyrics fuel violence in your estimation?
Well, I mean, ultimately, that comes back to the question that you asked your listeners. You know, like regarding the speech. The speech is protected. You know, like it is okay it is legally permissible to say these hateful things. It's protected by the Constitution. But the reality is that this music is music that is rooted in imagery and lyrics that are very 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 seriously violent. For example, one of Page's most recent albums for a band. That was not End Apathy. The cover was a picture of a white fist punching what was very clearly a black man's face, and bloodying it in a very very violent way. So I think to say this music is not violent is false. It is a violent music. Whether it creates violence is a question that I think remains to be answered.
It's the same question that, you know, gangster rap, some of those lyrics
right.
can be very violent, and you know, they face the same criticisms, and that making the leap is difficult, and free speech advocates would say dangerous.
Correct. I would agree with that completely.
Kathleen Blee, do you agree that these groups have grown from what Ryan Lenz from the Southern Poverty Law Center and his group has found? They've grown in number. And what do you attribute the growth?
Absolutely, groups have grown in number. It's harder to measure whether the membership has increased. These groups are very difficult to measure, to infiltrate, to count. But the number of groups has certainly grown, and Southern Poverty Law Center has been able to show that. I attribute it to all the factors that he mentioned, sort of racial issues in the country, but also to kind of the disintegration of the organization of the movement, so that it's now much more composed of lots and lots of different groups, some of them quite tiny, but that can be a structure that moves people to violence more than larger organizations. In the past, the hate movement, certainly early in the 20th century, was very organized, was interested in mobilizing lots of people. The Ku Klux Klan, for example, wanted to win electoral office. Nowadays, the hate movement isn't interested in that. They're interested in strategies to change the racial nature of our society, even to expel non-whites from this country. And for that, they need small groups of people who are willing to act on their beliefs, sometimes in violent ways.
If I could add to that.
Sure.
Well, since in the last 60 years, since the civil rights movement began, you know, the radical right has moved from a largely offensive stance to a defensive stance. And this question of violence, I think the answer might be rooted in that position. People are feeling threatened, which is why they've been drawn to these groups. Several years ago, the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, released a report warning that as these groups expand, that the possibility of violence was there. It was a report that they were deeply criticized for. a report that they ultimately, I think, backed away from slightly. But we've seen several instances of violence coming from this sector of our culture, beginning in 2009, most recently, when James Von Vrun shot some security guards at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, going up to last year when a neo-Nazi in Spokane, Washington, placed a bomb along a parade route for a Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebration. The bomb was ultimately dismantled, but it contained nails that were coated with rat poison to inflict maximum damage. So the prospect of violence is very real.
We're speaking about the state of the white supremacist movement in the United States in the wake of the shootings in suburban Milwaukee. Here on All Sides with Ann Fisher, 292-8513 is our phone number. Our email is allsides@wosu.org. And, of course, you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Ryan Lenz from the Southern Poverty Law Center, what's the state of the Klan these days?
Well, the Klan has shrunk considerably from, you know, it is sort of, you know, arguably the most famous of all the hate groups. It is a shell of what it once was. There are other groups that have grown considerably to take its place. You know, racist skinhead groups among them. There are all sorts of other white nationalist groups that have come out of the same sort of vein as the Klan. These are groups that consider themselves to be the smarter variety of more brutish, thuggish racists, groups like American Third Position, groups like a publication called American Renaissance. These are groups that have taken you know, the ideology of the Klan and moved it into sort of academia. Arguably, they argue that whites are not just supreme, but that all other races are, you know, quote unquote retrograde species.
Why do you think, Ryan, that the Klan is a shell of what it used to be, and these other groups have supplanted it?
I think there are a number of reasons, and I think that's probably a little more difficult to answer than. It's not simply answered. I think that there are the Klan might have run its course. The Klan had all sorts of baggage attached to it after being, you know, front and center during the civil rights era, and other groups have come along that whose message may be more appealing.
If I could jump in here,
absolutely,
just to add to what Ryan's saying, is that the other groups that have sprung up have a different composition than the Klan. So the new groups, they're younger. They have more women in them as well as men. They exist in all different parts of the country. So the kind of old-style Klan of older men, mostly in the South, it is being supplanted by a much more, I'm afraid to say, dynamic and heterogeneous set of groups that are attracting young people and people who are sort of more prone to immediate action.
The Klan was certainly a dangerous organization. We're a violent organization as well as being organized. Are these groups more or less dangerous than the Klan was? I'll let either of you jump in and assess that. Ryan, how about you? All right, go ahead, Kathleen.
This is really difficult to say. The Klan was extremely dangerous in its day. It was in its heyday after the Civil War. It was extremely dangerous. It organized terrorism throughout the South. It was extremely dangerous in the 1920s because it had major effects on election and policies and really ran various parts of the country quite completely. It was dangerous in the 1960s because it was a brutal assault on the civil rights movement. So it's just a different kind of violence that we're seeing now, looser, more strategic, more street level, maybe less centrally planned.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's difficult to compare.
Ryan, would you agree?
The more violent.
I would agree that it's very difficult to compare, but I will say that whether these groups pose a greater threat of violence, I think that there's some answer in the number of incidents that have been documented coming from these groups. Since, you know, we put together here at the SPLC a publication that we've called Terror from the Right, which is a listing of all known terror incidents, you know, radical right violence since 1995, and this is a list that continues to grow. Why that is? I think, as Kathleen noted, is maybe hard to answer. But I think the reality is very terrifying.
We're speaking about the white supremacist movement in the United States, where it stands. Of course, this is in reaction response to the shootings outside of Milwaukee at a Sikh temple. We'll try to get to some of the reasons behind the growth of the white supremacist movement when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Mitt Romney and the VP pick. After Al Gore, Dick Cheney, and Sarah Palin, we look at how vice presidents matter. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 70 degrees in downtown Columbus, scattered showers and thunderstorms off and on throughout the day, a high of 86 degrees. Expect more rain tonight along with some thunderstorms, a low of 68 degrees. Partly sunny, still a chance of rain on Friday, a high of 74. Clouds for Friday night, a low of 57 degrees. And then sunshine and a high of 76 for Saturday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're speaking about the white supremacist movement in the United States in the wake of the shootings outside of Milwaukee earlier this week. We're joined by Ryan Lenz. He's a senior writer at the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks these groups, and also Kathleen Blee. She teaches at the University of Pittsburgh and has studied and written about white supremacist group. One more question, Kathleen, about who these groups are and what they're doing. Are these groups focused on any one particular group? I mean, the Klan was primarily targeted at African-Americans, but also Jews and Catholics. Are these groups more divergent in the groups that and the minority groups that they're going after Muslim groups? I mean, we don't know the motivations precisely of what led to the shooting in Milwaukee, but it was a Sikh temple, a minority religion in the United States.
Absolutely. That's certainly a trend, and that's accelerated in the last few years. So the core enemies of these groups overall have been Jews and African-Americans, but now that's clearly broadened to all peoples of color and to other minority religions. That's a trend that I would anticipate would continue into the future.
Ryan, is the what's fueling the diversification of the enemies list, if I can put it that way?
Well, put simply, I think it's multiculturalism. I think it's, you know, it's an increasing acceptance culturally in the United States of different cultures. I think that as the country becomes more accepting of differences, these groups have had to adjust their approaches to attack those differences. Most recently we've seen a number of hate groups arise that have gone specifically after the LGBT community, and that might have been central to hate groups historically, it's a very real and very energized movement now as the country becomes more accepting of LGBT rights.
Kathleen, you'd think as multiculturalism becomes more and more a fact of life in the United States and more accepted, that the white supremacist groups would shrink, would get pushed farther and farther out to the fringe. Is that happening? Will it happen eventually, do you believe?
They may or may not be shrinking, but they're certainly pushed to the political fringe, and part of the venom and defensive assaults that they engage in have to do with the sense that they are fringe, that they are victimized. When I interview people in these groups, that's one of the common things that people will say. I'm the victim, not those other people, and I'm being pushed, and I have fewer and fewer rights. So they see themselves in kind of an upside-down world where they're the minority, they're being pushed to the side, and certainly social acceptance of overt, explicit racism is very low. All opinion polls show that that kind of explicit racism is considered very marginal by the society as a whole. But to those people, that's an energizing understanding.
Kathleen Blee from the University of Pittsburgh, when you interview folks who are members of these groups, where does the hatred come from?
Interestingly, it's often manufactured by being part of the groups. In other words, a number of people in these groups come from pretty ordinary lives. They grew up in kind of ordinary ways. They had kind of ordinary lives. And particularly people who get pulled in through, say, white power music, they can be very young. Their political opinions, their racial opinions can be quite unformed. And it's when they get into this world that they start, as they would say, seeing the truth, in quotes, where they start developing this really visceral hatred of Jews and people of color, of as Ryan said, gay and lesbians, and develop that into a strong idea that motivates their action, often in a violent way. But it's not always or even usually the case that they come in with those strong opinions. So the movement has a way of bringing people into an ideology, we would call it, a set of understandings that are quite powerful.
Ryan Lenz from the Southern Poverty Law Center, you mentioned the economy. Are more people drawn to this message, to these groups, when they're struggling economically?
Well, I think that's true, but it might be important to specify the group. We here track not only hate groups, but we track anti-government patriot groups. Sometimes there's some overlap, sometimes there's not. As the economy has suffered, you know, and people have seen themselves being victimized, again, to use a word Kathleen used, and to see them victims of a federal system, they've been attracted to any number of anti-government patriot groups. Absolutely, the economy is a factor.
How about geography? The Klan was based mainly in the South. Is that the case still, that these hate groups are located mostly in the South, or are they spread across the country now?
Well, I think there is some truth that across the South that there seem to be a larger number of hate groups. Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Arkansas, the states that you would expect. But then again, California, one of the states that's considered the most liberal in the nation, has 84 of them, you know. So, and that's quite a lot considering, you know, the comparative. So it's hard to, like, geographically, it does seem to be centralized in the South, but it's certain that I don't know if there's enough to say that that's a universal truth to it.
Kathleen, the folks you talk to, where do they come from?
As Ryan said, they come from everywhere. It's clear there are more in the South, but they're everywhere. In Pittsburgh, which is kind of a liberal city, there were people a couple years ago handing out racist skinhead flyers a couple blocks from my house. So it's a stereotype to think that these are rural Southern groups only. They're in cities. They're scattered around.
How does the American white supremacist movement compare to those movements in other countries? Ryan,
I'll jump on that. Well, I think that there is a lot of carryover, and we here look primarily at domestic hate groups and anti-government groups, though the message has resonance across the Atlantic. In Europe, this idea of nationalism has risen. There's been a large proliferation, a dramatic proliferation, really, of anti-Islamic sentiment across Europe, which has continued for many years. So I think it's a reality that in fact we many of the leaders of several hate group movements have been in discussion with their counterparts across Europe. David Duke spends most of his time in Europe, for example. The former Louisiana politician who was an outspoken Klansman. So there is some symbiosis.
If I could jump in, one big difference is that there are established extreme right political parties that successfully compete for office in a number of European countries,
and that's absolutely true.
Certainly not true here. So there's more of an institutional caste, a political party, an electoral caste to the extreme right in parts of Europe.
Are the targets of these groups the same in Europe as they are here?
As Ryan says, in Europe, there's much more focus on Islam as the enemy than has been characteristic of the United States, at least up till now.
The web, you mentioned how the web can spread the music. I assume that the use of the web, and now, I mean, how are hate groups using social media? I assume they are. Everyone is.
Well, there are any number of forums that exist, you know, that have international memberships where people you know, share ideas, events, news stories, you know, with whoever is reading the forum. As far as social media, you know, prominent members of a lot of these hate groups have social media accounts and post their rants and their hateful ideas there, and it's not hard to stumble across them and to be influenced or to at least see them. So there's a discussion that exists on Facebook frequently, and frequently we'll see someone post a statement or an idea or a reaction to the news, and then there's just a complete compounding of discussion really after that from all corners of the radical right.
And social media allows a very dispersed, uncoordinated network of haters to have a common communication, and
right.
also one that's very difficult to monitor.
That was my next question. Does Twitter, the other social networks, do they have rules against this? Do they try to monitor it and eliminate hateful speech, blatantly hateful speech on their platform?
I'm not familiar with Facebook's rules, so I can't answer
that
question.
Not either.
Yeah. Speaking of Facebook, Eddie on Facebook asks, I'll pose this one to you, to Kathleen. He wants to know what is behind the psychosocial motivation of individuals to join this movement. You talked that they come from sometimes fairly standard backgrounds, but what triggers the psychosocial motivation to join?
In my experience, it's mostly some kind of fear, and these groups are very adept at playing on fear. So, for example, women that I've talked to who come sometimes from very ordinary, even middle-class lives, middle-class jobs, join, for example, because they're afraid of sending their children to public schools. And these groups very effectively play on public schools, they argue, are chaotic, dangerous places. And then they move into a discussion of they're dangerous because there are people of other races there. And then perhaps they're dangerous because the whole school is controlled by Jews who make racial conflict worse. They ease women into this understanding, but based on a core fear. And they're extremely good at taking a fear and making that fear racial.
Right. That fear exists across the radical right. You know, I mean, with the Census Bureau predicting that by 2050, whites will no longer be the racial majority. The idea that manifests itself and translates to many people as a big threat. And you know, across the radical right, you know, in Arizona and across the Southwest. Fear obviously drives what we call the nativist movement, which is this fear of immigrants. So I would just agree completely.
292-8513 is our phone number. If you'd like to join our conversation, you want to pose a question, make a comment about the white supremacist movement in the United States, what's behind it, what can we do to lessen its influence. Let's go to the phones. And Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, thank you for having me. You already answered my first question: is why they hate Jews so much? Because if they have a religion, and it's based on Christianity, most of the writers were Jewish. And also, if they're so fearful of being dominated, why would God allow all these religions on one planet and it still exists?
All right, thank you, Steve. What is the role of religion in these groups, and how do they justify their actions if they are religious people? Kathleen, why don't you take that one?
Based on my research, the people I've talked to would think about Judaism or, say, Islam, not as a religion exactly, but as a race. So to them, these are non-white races that they argue control or threaten to overwhelm white Christian races. So it's not, they don't really debate theology. They don't really think of this as a planet with lots of different religions that could coexist. In their way of thinking, there is sort of the white Christian religion is the one religion, and other enemy races are threatening to impinge on the privileges of white Christianity.
We're speaking about the state of the white supremacist movement in the United States. Kathleen Blee is a professor at the University of Pittsburgh and has studied white supremacist groups. Ryan Lenz is a senior writer at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Ryan, does the Department of Homeland Security monitor white supremacist organizations, and are they doing an adequate job, in your estimation?
Well, I'll take the first part of that question first.
Sure.
They do, but to the extent that they do is arguably small. A number of years ago, we had a featured article in our magazine, The Intelligence Report, talking about how the Department of Homeland Security's unit, which monitored the radical right, which included hate groups as well as extremist anti-government groups, had effectively been gutted. That unit still exists. I'm not exactly sure in what state now. In recent years, we have seen the Justice Department go after a number of domestic terror threats. In Alaska, there was the Peacekeepers Militia that was run by a young and charismatic guy named Schaefer Cox. They went after them. There was the recent disruption of a plot in Georgia involving several people to attack government buildings with ricin and so on. So it appears that they are doing work. To what extent they're successful, that's up for debate. I'm not going to answer that.
Is it just a sort of a natural reaction to? I mean, we had Oklahoma City and the stepped up surveillance in the aftermath of that, but that was of course trumped by, you could say, by 9/11 and foreign terrorism threats.
Right. You know, after 9/11, the focus turned very clearly, to the quote unquote jihadist threat. But I mean, if you look at the number of groups that we've counted since 1995, especially on patriot and militia groups, in 1995 that number was at 809. And during the 90s, after Oklahoma City, in the late 90s, early 2000s, that number fell considerably. And then very specifically, and I think directly related to the election of President Obama, in 2011, those numbers spiked dramatically. So it went from a high of 858 in 1996, which was circa the Oklahoma City bombing, to a low in 2008 of 149 anti-government patriot groups. Last year, we counted 334, which is a dramatic increase in those groups.
I should also mention, to follow up, Brian, that part of the violence is coming from people who are called lone wolves. In other words,
right,
they aren't in an identified group, and those kind of people are very hard to identify in advance of their violence. They're very hard to monitor. These are people who are simply listening to white power music, perhaps reading internet, engaging with hate sites, but they're not necessarily going to meetings. They're not part of an identified group, and that's a very difficult challenge for law enforcement.
Right, and the organizational structures of these groups. You know, you asked a moment ago how these groups now how these hate groups now differ from the way the Klan existed, 70, 60, 50 years ago. These groups are largely decentralized. They may or may not have national leadership. They may or may not have regional leadership. So the prospect of lone wolf actors is very real. In fact, it was an idea that the idea of lone wolves, was born from some of the racist ideologues, 20 years ago, who thought that the greatest possibility to inflict damage and protect the white race was for proud white Americans to act on behalf of themselves.
We'll have to leave it there. Kathleen Blee from the University of Pittsburgh and Ryan Lenz from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When we return, let's look towards the Sikh religion. It's in the news, unfortunately, because of this shooting, but it's a faith that we don't know a whole lot about. And we're going to find out a little bit more about the Sikh faith when All Sides with Ann Fisher continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
In Cuba, President Raul Castro says he wants to reform the economy, but progress is slow. The Cuban population is aging and needs services the system can't provide. Young Cubans look elsewhere for opportunities. I'm Tom Gelton. What the future holds for Cuba, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And when you support our station, you can support us for as little as $5 a month. As a basic member, you'll receive some great benefits as well, including a one-year subscription to our program guide, Airfare Magazine, a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek Magazine, the WOSU FYIE newsletter, and a WOSU Public Media grocery tote. A basic membership starts at just $60. Visit WOSU.org and become a member of 89.7 NPR News today.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. Jazz Zoo continues with A Night in Vegas featuring the Columbus Gay Men's Chorus and Small Ensemble Vox Friday, August 10th at the Columbus Zoo. Gates at 6:30, showtime at 8. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and a look at the job outlook in Ohio. That's from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. 71 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies with rain off and on throughout the day and a high of 86. Showers and thunderstorms for tonight, a low of 68. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It's unfortunate it has taken a tragedy, but it is getting us to learn more about the Sikh religion. Let us take this opportunity nonetheless to learn a little bit more about this faith, which has a following of 20 million people around the world. Joining us now is Satpal Singh. He is chair of the World Sikh Council America Region. Satpal, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you very much, Mike.
I'm going to start right off the bat by asking you to forgive my ignorance, because I'm going to ask some pretty elementary questions. I'll ask our listeners to forgive my ignorance as well, because frankly, I don't know a lot about the Sikh religion, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are in the same boat. So that's why we're here, and some of my questions I'm sure will be pretty elementary, but I think it'll be a great learning experience. So please.
Sure, absolutely no problem, and thank you very much for providing us this opportunity to explain a little bit about what Sikhs are about.
Christians, Muslims, Jews believe in the same God. They diverge from there, obviously. Do Sikhs believe in the same God, in that same God?
In fact, that is one of the most important things we emphasize to everybody. Our scripture starts with the word Ik Onkar, which means one universal God, which means it's the same God for everybody, whether it's a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Sikh or a Jew. And in fact, one of the most fundamental tenets of Sikhism is that if you are a Hindu, be a good Hindu. If you are a Christian, be a good Christian. If you are a Jew, be a good Jew. Everybody has the same light of the same one universal God.
We're speaking with Satpal Singh. He's chair of the World Sikh Council, America Region. We're learning more about the Sikh religion and Sikhism. If you have a question, give us a call, 292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Can you explain the 10 gurus?
The faith started with Guru Nanak, who was born in 1469, and then he passed on his guruship to another guru. And in fact, this was not passed on hereditary lines. It was just to another most prominent follower who understood Sikhi much better than others. And then there onwards, there were subsequent gurus. And the tenth and the last human form guru collected all the writings and messages of various gurus and other spiritual people, whether they were Hindus or Muslims or of other faiths, into our holy scripture, and that holy scripture is our guru now.
Uh-huh. Can you, are these gurus, can they compared with Jesus, or are they more prophets?
They would be, the terminology in our own faith would be slightly different, but the best comparison I would make, would be with Jesus or with Buddha or other equivalent spiritual messengers of God, with one difference, coming from my ignorance again, these messengers are not considered to be God themselves. They are just messengers, and our worship goes just to that one universal God only.
Mm-hmm. So they're not divine. They don't believe in the divinity of the gurus. They are just strong messengers. Like
they are. Mm-hmm. They are divine messengers.
Divine messengers, but not divine themselves.
Okay. No, they are divine. It depends upon how we understand the word. They are divine, but they are not the one God themselves.
Mm-hmm. I see. We're speaking with Satpal Singh. He's chair of the World Sikh Council America Region. We're learning more about the Sikh religion and Sikhism. How do you worship?
We have our place of worship is called a Gurdwara. We get together there and we sing hymns from Guru Granth Sahib. That's our scripture. And it's mostly based on poetic composition and various measures of music. And we sing that and we discuss the meaning of that. And one of the most important institutions of our Gurdwara program is what is called as langar. So after the services are over, we all sit together and eat together. One of the most important components of the langar itself is that everybody is equal. And that's one of the most important messages among Sikhs, that everybody is equal, no caste system, no discrimination on the basis of color, religion, anything else. Gender equality is complete. There's no distinction between men and women, even with respect to any spiritual or religious services. Women can do everything. They can take part in everything. There have been women generals on the front of the battlefield. So all that is encapsulated at the end of the services in the langar, which is a free kitchen for everybody who can come and attend.
Okay. Let's go to our phones. Jesse, you're on the air with Satpal Singh, chair of the World Sikh Council America Region. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, I'm calling in, I'm Jewish, so I come from that sort of a background, and I know that Jerusalem has a lot of significance for a lot of different religions, and I'm wondering, you know, like, is there a holy land for the Sikh religion? Where are most of its followers concentrated? You know, where would you find them?
Great question.
Great question. Thanks a lot. Most of the Sikhs would be found in Punjab, in India. That's where the religion started. And there are a few very sacred places for us. And Darbar Sahib, which is commonly known as the Golden Temple in Amritsar, Punjab, would be one of them, with one distinction, that it's not a kind of pilgrimage place where we must go. It's just a question of one of the most important places for us was established by one of the gurus. Sikhs beyond Punjab are spread all over the world. There are about 700,000 in America and about 500,000 to 700,000 in Canada. And all over the world, they are present in many other countries.
Speaking with Satpal Singh, chair of the World Sikh Council, America Region, about Sikhism. Satpal, Sikhs are often confused, especially here in the United States. They're confused with Muslims and Hindus. Why is that?
I think it's simply because the religion or the faith originated in India, which was predominantly occupied by Muslims and Hindus at that time. And this is an independent revealed faith. It's often, as you said, mistaken as either being an offshoot of Hinduism or Islam. It's not. But because of its origin in that area, it's something equivalent to, if I may, for some people, if they were to say that the Jesus was born in a Jewish family, Christians are offshoots of Judaism, or they are part of Judaism. Some people believe that Sikhism is an offshoot of Hinduism, but that's only because of the historic fact that Guru Nanak was born in a Hindu family.
Like Lutherans and Protestant denominations in the Christian faith, they were born from opposition to some practices of the Catholic Church. Was Sikhism a response to Muslim and Hindu practices?
Yes, but there's more to that. Basically, as I said earlier, it's an independently revealed faith, but you're absolutely right. There were Hindu practices and Muslim practices which abounded in that area, and most of them related to there being differences among people and people being persecuted because of that. And one prime example of that would be discrimination against women, which was rampant both among Hindus and Muslims at that time. And another one would be caste system, where low-caste people were hugely persecuted. And the response was that, and one of the main things that Guru Nanak said initially, earlier on, was we are neither Muslims nor Hindus. We are human beings. And that is why our scripture starts with the word Ek Onkar. That means only one universal God. And the corollary thereof is very clear. Everybody is equal, and when we say equal, it's everybody is equal, period. Nothing else comes in between. So it was in response to many practices, burning women alive on the pyre of husband's death and things like that. So huge discrimination.
We're speaking with Satpal Singh, chair of the World Sikh Council America Region, about Sikhism. Your holy book, What is it like? I mean, the Bible has stories, has parables. Does your holy book have? Is it a collection of stories, or is it more of a guidebook, lessons, that kind of thing?
Great question. Our holy book is a collection of thoughts from various spiritual people, and it includes not only compositions from our gurus, but from other spiritual people, as I said earlier, from Muslim saints and from Hindu saints, including so-called low-caste people. As far as the contents are concerned, it mostly relates to what we think the divine is, what are God's attributes, and the message there is we should try to strive to achieve those attributes to whatever extent we can. And one of the most prime messages there is love of God. In fact, if I may say, we are not God-fearing people, but God-loving people. And love of God can be manifested in loving all of God's creation. There are no specific stories. There are, to the extent that the prevalent stories, which meant events or mythology, they have been taken in a context, and the message of love and equality has been explained in terms of those stories, in the sense that here is what is believed, but the message from there should be everybody is equal and we should love everybody.
So I take it there are no fire and brimstone stories.
If there is anything equivalent, that would be in a particular context. Uh-huh. And one of the things that we really take solace in is that our holy book has been both written and compiled by the gurus themselves. So this is not something which was later on an interpretation of somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Satpal Singh is our guest. He's chair of the World Sikh Council America Region. An email from Kate. She asks, she wants to know about the clothing. Is certain clothing required of members of the Sikh religion? We see the headdress.
Yes. Let me first, this question has two components, and it's a great question. The first component of clothing relates to one of the most fundamental principles, and that is the path of Sikhism, or Sikhi as we call it, is a path of, it's a journey of your conscience. It's not a journey of your physical body. That precludes, and I'll come to the turban in a minute, that precludes necessity of any physical rituals or anything. So there is absolutely no restriction.
No fasting.
Clothing, no fasting, no dipping in any holy water. There's no holy lake or, you know, a pond or anything like that for us. So no physical things. As far as the turban is concerned, that has a significance in another sense. We are supposed to keep five items of faith, which are supposed to have been given to us by our guru as a message of love. And our hair, uncut hair, is one of them. And the closest I can explain it to, compare it to, would be like a wedding ring, which is given by a spouse, and, you know, you wear it because it's a matter of love and, you know, faith from your guru in this particular case. And turban is to cover the hair, and in particular, it's a symbolism of declaring, pronouncing that this is who I am. I'm a Sikh, and thereby I'm responsible for all my acts. For example, if you see me doing something wrong in a grocery store or anywhere else, I'm responsible for it. You can say that there is a Sikh who did this. If I do some good deed, then I'm attached to it. It's like if I compare it to the army man who killed devotees in this Wisconsin Gurdwara. It's a question of his identity as an army man. So a uniform for an army man recognizes him as an army man. So it is for us with the turban.
All right. Thank you very much. Seth Pal Singh, he is chair of the World Sikh Council America Region. I apologize that it's taken a tragedy and a terrible story to make us learn a little bit more about your religion, but I think we've benefited from our brief conversation. So thanks very much for joining us here.
Thank you very much, and we thank everybody for their kind support and very strongly standing by us. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann here on WOSU 89.7, your all-day NPR news station.